Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
The United States has built an enviable system of higher education, whose graduates win more Nobel Science and Economics Prizes than those who've studied anywhere else. But that dominance may not last unless American universities make some important changes. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Taken individually, problems like excessive spending on administration, over-reliance on standardized tests, and professors in undergraduate classrooms who don't teach might not pose an existential threat to the supremacy of elite American universities. But the fact that they're happening as tuitions rise, sports programs draw focus from academics, and students understand college as a means to a lucrative job rather than education for its own sake signal real and urgent problems that my guest would like to address before it's too late. Jonathan R. Cole is John Mitchell Professor of the University at Columbia, where he has also served as Provost and Dean of Faculties and Vice President for Arts and Sciences. His new book is called Toward a More Perfect University. Jonathan, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here.
We should note off the top that your criticisms here are aimed largely at top-tier schools, the truly elite institutions of this country. What influence, though, do you think practices at those universities have on what goes on at less selective private schools and public colleges?
Well, it's a good question. I think that there are ways in which the elite selective colleges set the tone for others. They are policymakers in a way that others try to imitate, that others take the lead from. And the places like the Ivy League schools from Chicago or wonderful colleges are ones which make changes, and those changes are often followed by the 4,000 other colleges and universities in the United States. So they have a disproportionate impact to their numbers. But it's true, as you say, I'm focusing principally on the highly selective universities and colleges.
How did the United States come to have such a spectacular collection of research universities?
Well, it's a very interesting and not so long history. The first research university in the United States was the opening of Johns Hopkins in 1876, only 100 years after the American Revolution. And within about 50 years, the American university system, which was in many ways an amalgam of the French the German systems of research institutes and the undergraduate curriculums at places like Oxbridge and other British universities became the basis for the idea of the university in the United States. We had young people who were very talented, but we didn't really emphasize research. These were still places that were producing ministers more than scientists, technicians, scholars of other kinds. And there evolved a value system, a very important value system, that was set into place by 1930. And then by the end of the Second World War, the American system grew to a significant degree because of the very important intellectual migration which took place of those who were trying to escape from Nazi Germany and who populated American great universities and became leaders of those universities. And consequently, we found that by the end of the war, the American universities were really the best in the world, and they were increasingly getting very talented young people to enter them and enter the professoriate. So that was the point of takeoff, really. And since then, we have been the engine, really, of discovery and innovation in this nation.
You attended Columbia yourself at a time when it was highly respected, but still had a more local feel than the other Ivies.
Yes, I think when I entered Columbia in 1960, basically, it was more of a regional school than Harvard, Princeton, Yale, and some of the other Ivy League schools. But it was extraordinary in its own way. It was far more open to minorities, particularly Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. And they had an exceptional faculty who were interested in being in New York, and they had an exceptional student body, many of whom were very quirky and who turned out to be extraordinary, exceptional talents but in many ways unbalanced talents in the sense of, let's say, an Allen Ginsberg, who probably couldn't get into Columbia today because he might have received a C in chemistry in his sophomore year, turns out to be a terrific poet. Or for that matter, you know, who cares if Julian Schwinger didn't like, European history in his sophomore year or junior year in high school, if he turns out to be a Nobel Prize winning physicist. Well, we had many of those people, but they came generally from the New York area and the Atlantic area. Eventually, Columbia became very national and international, in fact, as have all of the selective colleges and universities in the United States.
When you had a family crisis, you were able to go personally to the assistant dean and explain, and he was able to find the money to allow you to continue your education without, you know, sort of an act of Congress.
Well, it's true. I was very lucky. Of course, the tuition in those days was about, a few thousand dollars at most a year at Columbia. And my father died unexpectedly when the beginning of my sophomore year. I went to the assistant dean, and without, any bureaucracy, without having to fill out any forms, he said, "We want you to stay at Columbia, and we'll add $500 to your scholarship." And that enabled me to stay rather than drop out of Columbia. And I think there are similar stories in that period of time among other people who had similar family crises.
You mentioned, I want to go back to something you said a few minutes ago about students who were unbalanced, and and I don't want to, you know, make too much of that word, but what you mean is that there was room for students who didn't absolutely excel in everything, and today it seems that even those who do make perfect grades in every course are afraid that they won't get into these schools. Is there something that we're leaving out, that we're losing, if we only consider students who have never made a mistake?
Yes, I think we are, in a very fundamental way. I think what we have witnessed in the United States is the tyranny of high-stakes testing and the belief that you can measure ability and all forms of ability by simply looking at people's SAT scores or their grade point averages and drawing inferences about their ability. In effect, we have taken the quirkiness out of our student body. The individual who would make a wonderful member of a class, but who is an extraordinary potential musician or a person who may be a poet or a great physicist or scientist, but who may not have interests in other subjects. After all, you know, when we consider the way in which the elite universities, the selective universities, consider themselves these days, it's one, by excluding 92% or 93% of all those people who apply, and then saying how proudly they are that their average admitted student has something like 2,300 out of 2,400 on their college board scores. But we know, you and I know, that there are very few people who are good at everything. If we're good at one thing in our life, we'd be very fortunate. And why do we require that everybody go down a straight, beaten path and do the same things, never deviate, never have an off year, never be passionate about one subject, and therefore exclude oneself from the possibility of getting into these highly selective colleges? The idea is to shape a class. It's not to shape an individual. And the Ivy League and many of the highly selective colleges, I think, have gone astray in the way in which they do admissions. I could speak more about that if you'd like.
Sure. Please do.
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, if you are a member of a faculty at a very good university, the faculty would never, never turn over to 24-year-old, hardworking, well-meaning individuals the right to choose and select new faculty members, nor would they allow those 24-year-olds to select the best graduate students. And yet, while America is so fixed on undergraduate education, and undergraduate education is so important, what do we do at even the most selective places? We turn the job of selecting students over to very hardworking, very well-meaning 24-year-olds, many of whom are not as able or as talented as thousands of the applicants to these schools, and they're allowed to make decisions about admissions without ever even consulting the faculty. The faculty are left out. And one of the things which I suggest to make us a still better set of universities is to bring the faculty back into the process of selecting their undergraduates.
What would that look like, and what kind of time would it require if this were to happen in any practical sense?
Well, it poses certain problems because the highly selective schools get so many applicants these days. So how would you handle this? One of the reasons we have so many applicants is because we have a common application. Each school does not define what it wants out of its students or what it's looking for in its students. It allows everyone to apply to 20 schools or 30 schools, and that ups the number. So Columbia, for example, has 36,000 applicants for maybe 1,600 positions. Hmm. So I would eliminate, you know, the common app and make an application that was true to Columbia and its values and its objectives, as I would hope other schools would do. Then I would allow essentially a first cut at the large numbers by staff members. But when it came down to 4,000 or 5,000, I would then begin to bring the faculty in as truffle dogs, as those who can sniff out talent and potential, and allow them to read and discuss the applications and how these people would rub minds together outside of the classroom, how they would form and shape a class that would have extraordinary value to them in their own personal development, in their development of identity, and in their future careers. Now, this committee of faculty members would not only have to be dedicated to undergraduate education, and there are many at the great universities who truly are, but they would have to be rewarded. They would have to be honored. They would have to have prestige to be on this committee. They would have to perhaps even be given extra compensation or a waiver from teaching a graduate course or something like that, so that they could be involved, as they do in medical schools, in making the final decisions about who should be admitted and who should not.
Do you think the greater danger, Jonathan, is that we are missing out on potentially terrific additions to these classes who don't look perfect on paper, or that we are allowing in people who do look perfect on paper that, you know, in real life maybe don't turn out to be the most productive members of the class?
I think it's a good observation, because I think we make, in a sort of technical sense, both false positives and false negatives. Now, what do I mean by a false negative? If we turn down somebody who's extraordinarily talented, like a Richard Feynman, who I believe Columbia actually did turn down, and he turns out to be one of the great, great physicists of our time, that's a false negative. We've made a negative judgment about that person, turned him away when he turns out to be one of the most talented people in his generation. False positives would be those students who come in and who might even do reasonably well, but are not really distinguished, and who go on to do very little in their careers and very little after school along the lines that we would hope them to work in. So whether that be in the humanities, the arts, theater, film, or science and technology. And the universities don't assess this. One of the things which they never really do is to take a hard look at the students that they have rejected, as well as the students who they have admitted, and see what the outcomes have been 10 or 15 years later. Hmm. There are medical schools that do this, and there are some professional schools that do this, but it's very rarely done, even among the most selective undergraduate colleges.
Jonathan R. Cole is my guest. He's professor of the university at Columbia, where he's also served as provost and dean of faculties and vice president for arts and sciences. We're talking about his new book, Toward a More Perfect University. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Fink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jonathan R. Cole, who is John Mitchell Professor of the University at Columbia. He's also served as Provost and Dean of Faculties and Vice President for Arts and Sciences. He has a new book out called Toward a More Perfect University. And if you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Generally speaking, Jonathan, how would the kinds of elite schools that you're writing about here define their missions?
Well, they really have three parts to the mission of great universities. One is the transmission of knowledge to our students, and that is perhaps our first calling. It can take many shapes as undergraduate education, as students are members of laboratories and scientific work. And it is certainly the second mission, and perhaps the most important in the eyes of the world, the external world, is the research and the discoveries that are made at these research universities. And that is something that is relatively new and which the United States has excelled at. Most educated Americans, for example, are unaware that the laser, the FM radio, the MRI, the GPS systems, barcodes, cures for childhood leukemia, the gene for insulin were all discovered at American research universities, as were the origins of computers, the discovery of recombinant DNA, the Richter scales to measure the magnitude of earthquakes, and as well things like public opinion surveying, which we're hearing about in the election year all the time, the concept of congestion pricing, human capital, the self-fulfilling prophecy. All of these concepts, ideas, and discoveries came from these universities and have had an enormous impact on the lives of Americans and the lives of people around the world. And that has had an enormous part to play in the mission of universities. And then the third, of course, is to try to build an educated citizenry who can participate well and knowledgeably in our democracy. So those are really the three key parts of the missions of most great universities.
Do you think that students can learn the way that they're supposed to learn? Well, let me ask it this way. You think it's important that students spend less time being lectured to and more time learning by doing, which doesn't seem like the model that has been in place at a lot of universities.
I think, Chris, that's extremely important, and I hope that we see more of that development, and I think the development of learning by doing will become more possible through the development of new technologies that can invert the classroom. People can actually listen to lectures and courses in their dormitory room or anywhere on their computers, and then they can come in and have conversations with professors about the problems that they face, the questions that they raise, et cetera. So I think the way we teach students will change dramatically. It won't necessarily solve the cost problem of higher education, but it could change the quality of education by inverting the way in which we teach people. There'll no longer be 1,000 students sitting in Memorial Hall at Harvard listening stoically to a professor dictate what his ideas are. I think those days are virtually gone, as a matter of fact. So I think the way in which we learn is also going to change, and I think you put your finger on it. In a strange way, we are going back to Dewey, to John Dewey's ideas of progressive education and learning by doing. It's now called constructivist education. There are other terms for it. But it is to combine both learning through actual experimentation as well as having fun with other students, other colleagues, and professors in the process of discovery and learning. And I think there will be far more of that. I mean, if you look at schools like the Bank Street School for Children and the Bank Street College in New York City, that is what they're teaching. And that's what they're trying to get other schools around the nation to be teaching. And I think we'll get more of that at colleges and universities. Stanford is taking the lead in this, as well as a number of other great universities.
How are professors recruited by the very best schools? What kinds of deals are struck to get people who are known nationally and internationally in their fields?
Well, there's been a long history, and a good history in many ways, of competition among the top schools in the United States. I mean, when the University of Chicago was first formed with money from John D. Rockefeller in 1892, their first president, William Rainey Harper, went out and started raiding all of the Eastern schools, whether it be Harvard or then Clark University, where Sigmund Freud gave his first American lectures. And they had an excellent faculty at the time. He was raiding them, and he was just bidding for them, outbidding them for them with Rockefeller money, taking people from Columbia. And the same thing happened, I must say, when Johns Hopkins came into being, and faculty members became increasingly interested in doing research. So Gilman, who was the president of Hopkins, started raiding Harvard. And there began early on, at the beginning of the 20th century, the era of academic free agency. And the competition has become only more fierce over time to get these extraordinary individuals on the campuses of one university rather than another. Now, to some extent, this has been very beneficial for American universities. For one, it's created new fields like biochemistry and others which have been derivative from the original fields of chemistry. Molecular biology would be another one. It's opened up new jobs for people. It's expanded the universities in very interesting and meaningful ways. But I think there's another side to this, and that is that we may have, in the 20th century, become too competitive. We may have too much of a good thing. And in the 21st century, if we're going to reach our full potential and understand the way knowledge is growing, we will try to be more cooperative and develop more cooperative strategies among these universities than we've had in the past.
So no more rating or less rating.
Well, it would be very nice if we could somehow get all of the best universities to no longer contribute to magazines like U.S. News and World Report, which I think give a very, very unrealistic view of the actual quality of many of these places. I'm not sure they'll do that, but I would hope that they would do that. Remember, my book in many ways is about what I think we ought to do, not what I necessarily think will happen. And I say that because social scientists like myself are terrible prognosticators, and it would be a fool's errand for me to try to predict accurately what a university is going to look like 25 years from now. But I do think that there are ways in which we can reach our full potential by changing the way universities operate. And one of them is the way in which we conduct research and compete for talented faculty and students. In my book, I have a chapter called Creating Academic Rather Than Sports Leagues. In that chapter, what I suggest is that because the problems that we face are so complex, like sustainability, global climate change, topics of inequality of wealth and income, these require the brains of people who are located at many universities. And I argue that what we ought to do is to create academic leagues in which strength will merge with strength and form alliances so that students and faculty can more quickly move towards solutions of problems and learn better with the intellectual resources of faculty members at many different universities. So, for example, you can take income inequality and wealth, and you can imagine a league that would be formed in which you would have Thomas Piketty, who has written famously now on capital and inequality, and there's another fellow, Rich Atkinson, at Cambridge and London, These are all people working on inequality, as well as Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize winner at Columbia, and people throughout the world, really. And why not combine the intellectual resources for them to be able to study, work, and try to find solutions to some of these vexing problems? That certainly is true already in certain fields of science. So that, for example, the discovery of the Higgs boson was really done at CERN. Now, there were thousands of scientists from scores and scores of countries that worked at CERN. They might have had their official appointment at Columbia, or they might have been at Harvard, or they might have been at Stanford, but they really were working at CERN, and they were really working together. And in that sense, we were forming sort of a global set of individuals who weren't competing with each other, but were really collaborating with each other. I think that that would lead to greater successes, greater discoveries, and a world which would be better for both students and faculty, less competitive, but more productive.
You insist that it is a myth that really superstar professors have no interest in teaching undergraduates.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I think that there is, because of the media and certain books that have been written, the common thought among the educated public that there is a big dichotomy between teaching and research. And yet, if you look at these selective places, you have not only great professors who are teaching undergraduates and graduate students, but whose evaluations by the students are actually higher than the students' evaluations of lesser known, and less decorated faculty members. So if anything, there's a slight positive correlation or association between the quality of research done by professors at these universities and the quality of their teaching, at least as assessed by the students.
Hmm. Are there ways to ensure that professors are really effective at communicating their knowledge to their students? It's always interesting to me that there's not, you know, you can be brilliant in your field and not necessarily have an education in educating.
Well, again, I think you're absolutely right. We don't do any work on pedagogy. You get in front of the classroom after you get your PhD and you start talking and you start asking questions and hope for the best in a way. But we are really very bad at assessing whether or not people are actually learning from these experiences. And we don't, you know, we have end of semester tests, but I can tell you that the students who get into these selective colleges, they can score well on any test. That doesn't mean that 6 months later or a year later they'll remember what you actually asked them about on that test. So what is the nature of that learning? That is why your prior question or your prior statement I thought was a very important one, which is that if we do more learning by doing, we have more students actually engaged in experiments, in laboratory work, in research, we know that they will retain that knowledge much better than if they're doing book learning, where the aim is to, on an examination at the end of the semester, get the right answer at the back of a book, rather than ask a set of questions for which there are no right answers.
Jonathan, why are administrative costs going up faster than any other expense line in most elite university budgets?
Well, I think there are several different sources for the increased administration. Some of it is actually the demands of parents and their students. I mean, there was a former president of Stanford University who once said that when he came from Stanford from Chicago, he found that there was an office for every teenage growing pain, and that had to be staffed by some administrator who was costing the university a certain amount of money. And he was kind of amazed that Stanford had all those programs. So there's a demand for, you know, four-star kinds of housing for students. And there's competition among schools over the quality of housing, over the quality of dining, over the quality of certain kinds of student services. There are some extremely important investments that are made administratively, like the mental health of students. We know that college-age students have very high levels relatively of suicide, and we should be spending as much money as we need to try to reduce that number substantially. But there are an awful lot of offices and activities at universities that are being asked for that are not really essential to the core missions of the university that I talked about before. But there are other sources as well. Let me take the federal government as an example. Most people would not know that there are over 4,000 regulations of research that have been promulgated by the federal government that universities have to attend to. A lot of that involves paperwork. An awful lot of it is unnecessary paperwork, but it is still there. It must be completed if you want to get a research grant, if you want to do almost anything. Now, I believe that this has resulted from a breakdown of fundamental trust between the government and the universities, which existed in abundance after the Second World War, but no longer really exists. And when there isn't trust, then the government is going to step in and try to regulate behavior. A lot of that set of regulations, some of which are based upon an incident of very bad behavior that the universities haven't taken care of properly, result in very, very sharp increases in costs. So let me give you a concrete example. It now is estimated by one study that was done by Yale and the federal government that a researcher who gets a grant from the National Institutes of Health spends 42% of her or his time on administrative work rather than doing science. Now, that is taking away from the national welfare. That absence from science is probably reducing the speed at which discoveries are being made. And most of the work is actually unnecessary. They involve, for example, monitoring your time on several grants and allocating your time accordingly. When, you know, a professor is smart enough to be able to divide this up and reach 100, which will be sufficient for compliance but will take time. There are really, as I say, scores of regulations that involve not just research but are other kinds. Now, there are very important issues that face universities, such as sexual assault on campus. The government has now promulgated regulations about how the universities should adjudicate cases of alleged sexual assault, and places like Columbia have hired 7 new people to deal with that. So there is where the administrative cost tends to be going up.
My guest is Jonathan R. Cole of Columbia. He is author of a new book called Toward a More Perfect University. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jonathan R. Cole, who is John Mitchell Professor of the University at Columbia University, where he's also served as provost. His new book is called Toward a More Perfect University. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. We have an email here from Harold in McKinney, Jonathan, that says, it's sad to hear someone telling me that getting their Master of Science degree, there were so many organizations that wanted their labor as an intern. Then when they received the degree, they ended up not getting a job in science or even an interview. Can you talk a little bit about how we can ensure that students who graduate from elite schools with science degrees will find work? Is this a problem as you've observed it?
Well, I think it is not as great a problem from the highly selective schools as from some of the other schools, but it exists at the selective universities as well. And I think that one of the reasons for that is that we pay a great deal of attention to what goes on campus and in the education of the students who, by and large, love the education that they get. They say that on surveys that are anonymous and that they take at the end of their senior year. But we don't really emphasize and we don't spend very much time in outplacement. That's true for the professional schools, these universities, as well as undergraduates. So we don't have staffs which are really trying to help students locate jobs that they're interested in, that employers are interested in, to try to show off their talents and to make a good match so that they can use their creativity to develop after college. So I would agree with the person who emailed in and say that we have not done a very good job, quite frankly, at trying to help our graduates get appropriate jobs, good jobs, and staff our universities in a way that makes these very important decisions much easier for the student.
I think many people today would agree that diversity among the student body and on the faculty can make a university stronger. You note, though, that along with ethnic and racial diversity, economic diversity should be a goal as well.
Yes, I think all kinds of diversity should be part of great universities. It's not only demographics, it's not only socioeconomic status, but it is types of people. I mean, when I was talking earlier about shaping a class, of course I want people to rub minds and with other students who come from very different backgrounds, different cultures, who speak different languages, who maybe have different racial identities, who may have gender identities which differ from their own, who have cultures, come from cultures where the practices are very different from those that we see in the United States of America. This is part of the learning experience. But I also want to see diversity of talent as well. I want to see the concertizing musician who is going to be at one of these the schools, the person who's going to be a great artist, the person who's going to write critical essays about the state of social arrangements in the United States. After all, a great university should be unsettling, and the people who go there should be questioning, they should be skeptical, they should be willing to engage each other with their priors, their presuppositions, and be willing to debate those kinds of things. I think that happens far better when there is a very diverse population of students on all dimensions, not only demographics, but as well in terms of ability as well, and different forms of ability.
Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with David in Trophy Club. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
So my question is this. I went to an elite liberal arts college, one that's always near the top of the U.S. news rankings, and I got my transcript and I graduated, and I had a 3.2, which is pretty good, but I was in the bottom third of the entire student body. So my question is, great inflation, this was many years ago, but do you see that as a problem now, especially in the humanities, and if so, how do we solve it?
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think there has been great inflation, and the only way to do that, to solve that problem, is collectively. And not any single school can do it alone. But, for example, if you were to get 100 colleges and universities together and say that this is going to be the standard type of grading that's going to be done, then I think you might be able to make some movement away from grade inflation. But I think that, once again, you know, grades are not the only feature of a person's record and illustration of their abilities that employers ought to be seeking. And I, in fact, think that employers are increasingly thinking about the skill sets of people in terms of their writing, their analytic skills, whether or not they can work well with others, et cetera. So I would hope that grade point averages are less important at these selective colleges than they seem to be. But it's a very good question, and I think we need to do more collective work again to solve that problem.
You suggest something that sounds really radical here, and that is that Congress mandate a retirement age for tenured university professors.
I don't say that they should mandate a retirement age, but they should be an age at which tenure ends, which could be not the Bismarckian age of formal retirement, which used to be 65. Life expectancy has gone on beyond that. So, I mean, I could say that somewhere between 70 and 75, Congress could change the Age Discrimination Act and say that university professors no longer would have tenure after, let's say, the age of 73 or 75. They could still be kept on at the university if they're highly productive, but they would be kept on annual contracts. But one wants to open up the university to new and vibrant and terrific new talent. And if the veins and arteries of the university are being clogged by older people, many of them are still creative, but some are not, and they're there because of tenure and the inability to move them out because of tenure. And tenure, which I very much believe in, by the way, because I believe in academic freedom and the protection of academic freedom, and I think tenure does that. But for older faculty members, it may be less important. Nonetheless, their academic freedom should be protected. But we need to unclog the arteries of the universities and open it up for more people to come in. If we don't do that, there'll be fewer and fewer people who will aspire to faculty positions because they won't think there are any available.
Meanwhile, many people who would aspire to faculty positions, perhaps not at elite universities, but elsewhere, can only find themselves, you know, like jobs as adjuncts for $1,500 a class per semester. Very low amounts of money.
Yeah, I think that's a terrible situation in the United States, and I think it's got to be reversed. First of all, there are two ways of doing this. One is to attack the problem by combining adjunct positions into full-time positions. The problem that adjuncts face is not only do they have to scurry about and they teach 5, 6, 7, 8 courses in the course of any semester in order to just eke out ends meet, but they don't even have benefits. They don't even have health benefits and other kinds of benefits that normal faculty members had. I think this is a terrible situation that should be and must be rectified. But there's another reason why we've had an increase in adjuncts, and that is because there has been an incredible decline in the state support of higher learning. Since 2008, there has been a 30% decline in the revenues that states have committed to institutions of higher learning. So as those budgets fall, these universities are constrained in the hiring they can do, and consequently, they tend to go for the cheapest labor, which is often PhDs, very well-trained people, who are willing to work for very low wages and very few benefits. Now, the states have got to realize the value of their educational institutions, especially their great institutions, the value to the economy of their states, the value to the people of the states, the pride of the states. I mean, you were talking, I think, in the first part of your show about prisons and incarceration. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to listen to that. But do you know that in the last 8 years, the amount of state revenues going to prisons has increased by 134%, while it's declined 30% to universities? If we took some of these people out of prison and put them to school, and we could pay for their tuitions three times over in the states, we would probably be doing something much more productive than keeping them incarcerated. But let me simply say that this is a matter of values. If the people value higher education, one would hope that they would elect legislators and officials who would see the wisdom of investing and reinvesting in higher learning and in our human capital of the future. There's not much payoff in investing heavily in prisons, frankly. And that's a revealed preference. If we invest more in prisons than we do in higher learning, that's telling us something about what people value and don't value. I hope that as time moves on, we can persuade the public that the investments in education pay off far, far more than investments in things like new prisons.
We have time for one more call from Drew in McKinney. Hi, Drew.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. So just to preface this, I know I'm 30. I've got two kids and, a full-time job. Do you think there's a future and value in online and competency-based programs for someone to achieve the same level of education?
Well, I definitely think there is room for increasing one's skill sets through online education. I think online education is important for people who are in certain kinds of situations. I do not think that it's going to replace bricks and mortar at the very top colleges and universities in the country. And in fact, it's far more costly than people think. There's no business model that really works thus far. But I must say that if you're trying to get a better job and you are out there working hard, have a family, and need to continue to work in order to support that family, and you would like to improve your skills in a variety of ways, then I think online education is one way to do it. But you've got to pick out a good program and use that program as a means to really learning these new skills. So there is going to be technological revolutions in higher education. I don't think they're going to replace bricks and mortar and the need of people to be together. If for nothing else, sex will make bricks and mortar still real. But the fact of the matter is that we are going to have more and more high technology entering to education, but being used along with very, very fine teachers to improve the quality of education, not necessarily to reduce its cost.
How should universities assess student learning and mastery of the subjects they've gone to study?
Well, that's an extremely good question because we don't do very much of that. In fact, there's very little study of the value added of the education at any institution, whether it be Harvard or Stanford or Princeton or Columbia or the University of Texas, the University of Michigan, and the University of California. We don't study value added. It may just be that smart people come in and smart people go out, and their education in between has not made a big difference. I think we have to begin to assess, not only in undergraduate education but in professional schools, what is, in fact, the value added of the education that is received in those schools. So if we take a school like, let's say, a social work school, we should be measuring what these young people know when they enter social work school and what they know afterwards. And we should compare that with people who don't go to social work school but who spend 2 years or 3 years on the job and see whether there's any difference. Is the curriculum actually making them more analytical, better social workers, better at dealing with people, et cetera? And we don't really know the answers to that question. And it's an embarrassment, in fact. Universities should do far, far more on this. And until they do, they won't make a good case for the value of some of their educational programs.
Jonathan R. Cole is John Mitchell Professor of the University at Columbia, where he has also served as Provost and Dean of Faculties and Vice President for Arts and Sciences. His new book is called Toward a More Perfect University. Jonathan, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you for making this time for us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones this hour from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.